Hi, friends. Welcome to another episode of the 10 Laws Podcast with East Forest. I'm East Forest. How's it going? Thanks for tuning back in, and thank you for subscribing, all of our regular listeners. Special thank you to everyone in our Patreon, East Forest Council. That's a spot where we give some podcast extras, things like that, advanced listen to music. I actually just shared the song that's coming out this Friday, which is called Bones, featuring Bio Akamalafe. It's the next single off of the Possible album. But over there on Patreon, they've already heard it. We also have a monthly Zoom council with certain members in our Patreon council. And that was so beautiful last month. Really, thank you to you guys for, guys and gals, of course, and genders of all persuasions. Thank you for showing up and witnessing one another. It nourishes me, and it's just great to see like new connections forming between people and taking those offline and just deepening our work and our journey together. So if you want to check that out and see if it's something you might want to go into or a way to support this podcast, I sure appreciate it. It's patreon.com/eastforest, or just go to eastforest.org and you can scroll down there, I think on the homepage, and you'll see some more information about it. This week, I have a conversation with Nick Norris. Nick is an amazing guy, and he was very like open and welcoming with his storytelling on this podcast, which is always just amazing to witness people just like open up. But he's a former Navy SEAL and just has a really amazing story. So I don't want to like give too much away, but I think you're really going to enjoy this podcast. I first heard him, I believe, on Tim Ferriss's show, and then we got connected, which we talk a little bit about. And it just felt like, you know, I'm always into good stories and listening to how people sort of walk their own walk and the lessons that they've learned from their own process. Because that's really what it's about, is each of us trying to find, we learn from the stories of others, and we put that into the greater story of all that is as we're building a new story, a new way of being that perhaps is an old way of being. But for us, we're trying to clear away this noise that is around us and understand how to get back in touch with that which is always there, finding our stars that we wish to navigate by. And that's up to you individually, and it's unique to your journey. And so I hope that these conversations and stories are ways for us to listen. And by listening, I trust that wisdom can come through, and you'll be able to empower yourself to make some good choices, and hopefully, well, they'll be your own choices. Before we dive into that, I just want to say that we do have those new sweatshirts and women's tanks in the shop now. The beautiful Uroboros Possible artwork is on these really beautiful kind of heather blue sweatshirts that are kind of modern and very, like, they're super comfortable. But go, you can check out the shop at eastforest.org. And we also have the pre-order for the vinyl of Possible. And it's on this really cool iridescent, sort of also bluish vinyl. And that's going to ship in July. So next month, July 2021. And the full album comes out on July 23rd. So if you want to grab one of those first pressings, there's not that many of them. I think we pressed 500. Now's a great time. So head over to eastforest.org. And other things will be updated. So if you want to join the mailing list, you could find about retreats, and we're talking about some more and updates, all sorts of that sorts of jazz, tour dates, yada 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 yada. Okay, thanks for subscribing and thanks for reviewing. Really appreciate that. And I'll catch you next week. But for now, let's get into this conversation with our new friend, Nick Norris. Maybe you could just give us a little background on who you are. And you mentioned, I think, that you do some work with some vets, and maybe some of those vets are SEALs or not. And just sort of, because I want to get in a bit to what that is looking like, you know, what people are diving into as modes of healing. Because certainly it's interesting, like, what's working for vets, but, you know, vets are people just like anybody else. And so I'm kind of interesting what the crossover is with everybody for sure. Different forms of healing and modalities and kind of like what you're running into that's working and not working.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I think there's a beautiful conversation to be had.
Yeah, well, so, let's just start with who you are a bit.
Yeah.
A little background before I get too far ahead of myself.
Yeah, so I'm Nick. Nick Norris. You grew up in Chicago, attended the Naval Academy out in Annapolis, Maryland, with the aspiration of joining the SEAL teams as a young guy. And I pursued that dream to fruition and, you know, made it through SEAL training and spent about 11 years on active duty serving in the SEAL teams from like 2003 through 2013. You know, had the privilege of serving with guys overseas and really, you know, doing something that I saw as both impactful in the world and then, you know, very purposeful to me. You know, a lot of deep connection, you know, within that community, you know, to each other. And, you know, we kind of had a deep shared sense of purpose for many, many years, you know, going overseas to protect people. I mean, that's kind of how I frame it to a lot of people. It's not going overseas to, you know, be a destructive force or a weapon of, you know, of somebody else's choosing. For me, it was really, you know, going overseas with a group of guys to defend people and take care of people that couldn't take care of themselves or who were disenfranchised and unfortunately, you know, thrust into situations that are just, you know, not right for any human beings.
Well, there's a mystique around the SEAL teams, and I would imagine a lot of mystery too, because I think most people would imagine it is, well, how accurate do you think that is to what people think SEAL forces are? I mean, let's just, to be clear, I would assume it also is a method of aggressive force too, at times, very much purposely so. We know that to be true. Maybe that wasn't your experience, but that's what I certainly don't know firsthand.
Yeah. Typically people think of the SEAL teams, or I guess SOF, special operations for that matter, as a very aggressive means to, you know, get things done as it relates to foreign diplomacy.
Yeah.
Very quiet kind of targeted surgical fashion. And absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, we were called to do our nation's bidding. But it's deeper than that for us. You know, there's a deep sense of fraternity within the community. And, you know, I think the core driver for most of the guys, if not all of the guys that I served with, was, you know, to be a force of good, you know, and go into places where, you know, evil has permeated and, you know, people are, you know, innocents are treated very poorly. You know, they're, you know, killed, tortured, you know, taken advantage of. And, you know, the driving force for the guys that I served with, myself included, was really to be a protector, you know, to take the fight to the bullies, to the people that were taking advantage of people that couldn't protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you reconcile that inside like a system that of something like the U.S. military, where it's built on this hierarchy of like people following inside the chain of command, where it's not, I mean, on one level, people are supposed to have that volition of joining up in a volunteer force and say, I want to be a part of this. But after that, it's supposed to say, like, then you're supposed to essentially do what you're told to do. And I imagine there had to be things you didn't want to do, or maybe it's like it's breaking down. Like you don't want people saying like, well, I want to do this, I don't want to do that, or I'm comfortable with this, I'm not comfortable with that. You're supposed to do it. And I would imagine that is part of the reason why after people retire or they're done, that's where the grief and the healing needs to happen, because there's this element of humanity that has to be turned off on some level in order to do the job, I would imagine.
Yeah, you know, so I've spoke at length with other folks about what makes us so effective overseas. Mm. And I point
when you say
to,
us, do you mean special operations or like America?
I think special operations. I mean, I don't want to exclude other sections of the military, because there's very effective members of the military that weren't special operations. I mean, I served alongside Marines and Army infantry that...
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah,
yeah, and there were heroic individuals that were extremely capable and good at what they're doing. But I think generally soft special operations, the guys, you know, are very good at compartmentalizing. Mm. So basically taking emotion, you know, feeling and pulling it out of the decision-making process in order to really be effective and deal with stress effectively and efficiently. But, you know, when I say that we're good at compartmentalizing feeling from those situations, I will emphasize the fact that, like, guys, you know, the guys I served with and the guys that are, you know, capable leaders in our community were very, very good at discerning right from wrong. I mean, in a situation overseas that's very gray, you know, it's not black and white all the time. You know, you're dealing with a combat environment, which a lot of people, they think it's just good guys and bad guys on the battlefield, and that's what's happening. But, you know, it was, you know, we were deployed into people's, you know, their home, right? I mean, people lived and worked and went about their daily routine amongst, you know, major conflict and combat. And, you know, it forced us as, you know, Americans on the battlefield to really, you know, be very, very good at determining what is right, what is wrong, how do you mitigate the impact of, you know, these combat operations when you're dealing with a bunch of civilians and people that are innocent. So
yeah,
I think we do a really good job at maintaining the moral high ground, even when you're dealing with, you know, an adversary that didn't necessarily follow the rules and didn't necessarily carry out their actions with morals in mind and ethics.
Yeah. When you say shades of gray, I mean, I appreciate that because I think we can probably all recognize that in these modes of conflict, it isn't so clear cut. I mean, you can have clear motivations on like actors and what maybe you're trying to do, but you start adding in all the layers of, you know, American history and imperialism mixed with like every other country that was involved and all the different things going on mixed with just like the humanity of each person trying to do what they're trying to do or mm-hmm. what happened to them in their life and what brought them to this moment and the traumas and the chain of traumas. And it's very complicated.
Sure.
You know, it gets, and I would imagine, like, did you feel like there was an awareness of like, in a sense, like how fire breeding fire, it's like, it never ends in a sense. Like we've looked back in time and it's like, you know, we can always kill the bad guys, quote unquote, or make that our mission. And sometimes that's maybe needs to be done. But vice versa, it's like, where does this go?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm
just curious how, if that was like a present thing or that had to be compartmentalized too, because it was just like a loop of insanity, maybe.
I always embraced it, you know, as a leader, and I, you know, I served in a leadership role when I was overseas in combat. I embraced it as, you know, I know what is right and what is wrong as a human being. And I guess more recently as a soul, as a, I'm very much in touch with kind of, you know, my God and, you know, the divine aspects of myself. And I think that's always been present in me. And it might have not been as clear cut and I didn't really identify it, but, you know, my intuition and my gut, you know, often just guided me in the right direction. You know, it's hard to describe, but like, or explain, but I understood what was right and what was wrong. And that goes to, it's present even in situations where you are fighting a known combatant. You know, if somebody is, for instance, if somebody is, you're in an engagement, you're in a firefight, you know, they're shooting at you, you're shooting at them, you know, you're trying to kill each other in that situation. There comes a time where, you know, once that threat has been mitigated, if people are not shooting back at you or you've taken them into custody, you know, you then treat them as a person, as a human being. And I think the the ability to know what, just feel what is right and wrong. I mean, it's very clear cut in that situation. It's like you don't treat that person poorly at that point. You know, you're not, you don't take advantage of their inability to protect themselves. You know, you treat them with civility and you treat them like a, you know, a human being. So as complicated, yes, as tough as a situation as you're thrust into, you know, the right and wrong, good and evil still exist.
Yeah, and I appreciate you allowing me to push a little bit here. I mean, it's part of it's just for the sake of the conversation, and I don't mean it with any disrespect. And I can value that just these experiences are like have a level of challenge and risk that most people never experience in their lives. So it's easy to sit from this position and think about it, and you know, but I'd like to keep going though. So
let's keep going. I mean, I it's good to talk about it because I think a lot of people don't understand, you know, what our nation has asked us, you know, as service members to go overseas and do since 9/11, and it's not just going out and executing kind of political agendas. It's, you know, for the people that are serving, that are actually out there doing the work. We all know that, you know, we're out there trying to protect, to trying to help other people, and it's, you know, people may not totally get that because you're not there, but you know, in the time I spent overseas, I saw people treated so poorly and taken advantage of, and I saw atrocities that, you know, no living being should be subjected to. And, you know, what fueled me was stopping those type of things from happening. You know, no different than, you know, in our country, you know, stopping injustice, stopping, you know, assault and murder and rape and molestation and all the terrible things that, you know, surface on a daily basis here, you know, where we're not at war, right? We're not in a combat zone. But, you know, I think as human beings, we're always called to thrust ourselves into that scenario to stop those things from happening. And, you know, that was the driving force overseas, right? It wasn't like we were just fighting this person because they told us to do so. It was like I got to see what was being done, and we just wanted to do something about it.
Yeah, and I hear like this warrior with a heart, which is beautiful. And I also hear that like when you're thrust into those situations, like on the ground, there's things you're reacting to that are clear injustices to you, and yet it's inside this machine of dominance. You know, it's like, you know, you could. Is not, you know, breaking, zooming out from like you, the individual soldier, helping an injustice on the ground. It's like we're there in the first place. Like my father is a vet from Vietnam, and he was drafted, and he went through officer training and did the whole experience, the GI Bill. But I don't think he looks back on that thinking like, that like America's involvement on the greater scale was a good idea. Maybe, you know, I was like. And not, let's not even make it black and white. Maybe there's aspects of it that were smart and aspects of it that were clearly not smart. Even modes of deception on a political level, of like Bay of Pigs and stuff. And we know that kind of stuff is out there. And there's duplicitous motivations, such as just like American hegemony of, you know, believing that, look, we have to keep, you could say we have to keep the American economy strong so that we can be the superpower, so that we can be the policeman of the world. And if we weren't, this whole place would go to shit and to chaos, is one sort of neo idea. And so therefore we need to take all the oil fields, or we need, that is the reason we need to do it. But there's it's not just greed. It's like greed's the byproduct because we need to be a superpower because we're the good. That is a mindset, you know? Mm-hmm. And inside that mindset, now we're out there as the global police force while we're enriching ourselves at the same time, and it gets murky. And this is geopolitics and war and stuff. And so, and you go zoom back down to you as the soldier on the ground, and you see someone doing a horrible thing to another person. Yeah, you want to stop that. I mean, it's great that you even were in a sense able to do that or be in that position inside this huge momentum of a machine of American power and dominance. So maybe I'm overthinking it, but I know for myself, I would be aware of that and be like, wow, like, how do I reconcile all of this while I also just want to help that person across from me?
Well, you know what's, when you're in it, and I can't speak for everyone, but I know a lot of the guys, including myself, became very apolitical while you're serving. It's interesting to see that when you are faced with your own mortality and you're faced with things that are much more...
Pulls the politics out.
Yeah, it throws all the politics out the window and all of the political drivers and you know, the facade that may or may not be kind of presented in order to kind of push an agenda. It all falls away when you're faced with your own mortality and the mortality of others. So it's I was very apolitical. I didn't really care. I hate to say care. I always cared, but it was like, it didn't bother me if it was a Republican or a Democrat in the office of the presidency. They were the commander in chief. You know, we voted that individual into office, and we're going to go and execute kind of the things that they want us to do. But never would I compromise my own ethics, my own moral fiber on the battlefield. That was always paramount for me, and it should be paramount for any leader that is thrust into a scenario where they are able to make decisions that impact, you know, the life or death of people, not only on their side but on the other side. And
amazing that you didn't have to, through your entire career, face a situation where you felt you had to compromise that personally.
I think that's what all good leaders should do. You know, you never should compromise that. I mean, if the second you start to compromise that, you should step down, because when you compromise that, that's when atrocities happen. I mean, then there's countless examples, you know, throughout, you know, history, but even with recent history. You know, you mentioned, you know, the Vietnam War, and you have atrocities like My Lai that happened in Vietnam, and it was a breakdown of morals and ethics, of right and wrong, that allowed an atrocity like that to happen. It's a failure of leadership. And if people fail to be leaders in that situation, it's zero compromise. You know, they need to be pulled out, and they can't be put in a situation to lead if they're willing to compromise.
It seems also like a failure of the human spirit, you know, being put into a situation that's so against, like, the natural cooperation that I believe we have as people, and this breakdown of, like, we know that when certain pressures are put on human beings, we tend to reliably go in certain directions that are not very pretty. It's part of our animal nature. And we've seen this in psychology experiments over and over again. And that was a horrible example of perhaps like what it's like when the enemy is everywhere. It's your friend, and in a night they put on the black pajamas, and it's just never ending. And it's like, it seems pointless, but it seems like, and you just break, not just on a leadership level, but like many people breaking, you know, and it's just like a complete breakdown of reality.
Yeah.
And that speaks to me about something about sort of the friction that is in war, like in the ways that you're speaking about the compartmentalization is a way of saying, you can't fully hold and examine certain things because it's too much. On a certain level, we want to be cooperative. We can't snap our fingers and make it happen. But the more we go down that road, it's incongruous inside of us. And so I'm hearing you, we could lead this into the next phase of the conversation, that there is something that happens there that creates a trauma on an individual level.
Yeah.
And that's something that we all see that needs to be dealt with, particularly in vets. It's a particular kind of acute trauma that has been going on for millennia, but only in maybe the last decades and century, we're really giving name to it and even seeing the effects in the brain and so forth. So I know you've done a little work And I'd like to get into that and speak about what it is you saw happening and what your involvement was. And then I'd like to talk about that a bit.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I guess I would start by saying that the suppression of emotion, you know, namely grief, has been something that I've identified personally as kind of a major driving force behind a lot of the suffering that guys deal with that come back from combat. And at least within our little community within special operations, you know, I personally dealt with that, and I've watched a lot of other guys, you know, come to the conclusion that, you know, they've been suppressing grief for a long time. And it's not just grief, you know, for the guys that you've lost, but it's, you know, probably grieving in a way for, you know, kind of all, you know, everything that you've seen, like the overwhelming confrontation with mortality on a daily basis and having to numb yourself to, you know, watching death, you know, on a regular basis. You know, guys, if you got so caught up in that in the moment, it would detract from your effectiveness to make, you know, effective, timely decisions on the battlefield. And, you know, that stuff gets locked away and it festers. And if you don't address it, you know, things, you know, bad things happen. You know, guys turn to alcohol, you know, to other drugs, you know, to numb. It destroys families and relationships because you're so fixated on, you know, trying to deal with kind of suppressed emotion. So that was a big part of it for me personally. You know, I witnessed myself fall into a period of apathy, and it would be framed, I guess, as depression. And it was framed as depression, though I didn't feel depressed. I just felt very flat after multiple years post-exit from the military. You know, I felt like I used the word I felt, but I wasn't feeling at all, really. I felt nothing. I didn't feel good about things that I normally would find joy in. And I definitely was not dealing with grief and loss the way that I should have for a long time.
And dealing with grief, like, did you find that for you that meant just feeling it?
Yeah.
Like allowing it to be felt and go where it needs to go, as opposed to, I would presume, not feeling it and pushing it away.
Yeah, I mean, within the military, for sure, I did, you know, I had lost friends in tragic situations, and you have a short window to grieve, and then the grief is done, and it doesn't serve you, and you move on, and, you know, a week sometimes isn't enough time to process the loss of a close friend or a family member. And I saw it even outside of the military. You know, I lost a father when I was very young in the SEAL teams, and I lost a younger brother tragically in an inbounds avalanche in 2012. And he left behind a wife and two young children, and I didn't, you know, I had the same mentality that I had as an active duty SEAL. I, you know, I grieved for a very short period of time and then turned it off in order to be the voice of reason and the rock of stability for everybody else, you know, in that situation, namely his family, to try to be a problem solver. And the emotion didn't serve me, or at least I didn't think it served me. It didn't,
right.
It clouded my ability to, you know, make things better for other people. And, you know, that's tough. I mean, I guess where I am now and what I have found is that my ability to embrace that loss and feel it has been absolutely liberating for me.
Yeah, so talk to me about how or if that came to a head in a way. I hear that it formed a kind of latent depression. And, you know, what is it you found that helped you work through it, and whatever maybe you've been, how that transferred to other vets as well?
Yeah, so I got out of the military to focus on my family, namely because my my brother was killed, and I got to see the impact of that loss on his kids and his wife. And it, you know, it hit home because I had a wife at the time who was pregnant, and I was going down that path. So I decided to depart. And, you know, I made the decision to get out of the military to be there for my family, yet I found myself kind of drifting away from family because I was unable to really feel and connect with them. And not to take us completely off track, but you know, multiple years after that, I had a near-death experience, which I've spoke about openly. I drowned in Hawaii a couple years ago.
And, a couple years ago?
Yeah, a couple years ago, as I was with my brother in Hawaii. Wrong place, wrong time, you know, fought in a very bad situation to unconsciousness and had a, yet I had a pretty impactful experience where I got to, in my mind, I feel like I crossed over for a short period. And it was super powerful for me in that the only thing that I cared about in that moment and was my two children and my wife, and I felt like I was with them. It was like kind of this moment, this eternal moment of kind of understanding what love is. And it was presented to me in the love that I have for my kids and my wife, but namely that parental love. And it really hit me. Actually, at first, I couldn't integrate that at all. It actually felt like it was more traumatic. And I locked again, went back to my compartmentalization. It scared me. I locked it away and didn't want to even talk about it. You know, it became kind of a topic that I glanced over upon returning from that trip and from the hospital. And I didn't address it again until, you know, my first major experience with psychedelic medicine.
Okay. Were you swimming or surfing or?
I was.
You were in the ocean, I presume?
Cliff jumping in the ocean.
Okay.
Which, you know, it was a recipe for disaster in the place that we were and just the timing of you know, that swell coming in. You know, I got caught in a very bad spot where, you know, I couldn't save myself, and I fought until I could fight no more, until I had my brother actually enter the water once that setup subsided and kind of pulled me unconscious out to sea, and was able to flag somebody down who just happened to be offshore. And, you know, I owe them my life because I probably wouldn't be here talking to you today if it weren't for them.
Did you just jump in and there was a rip that pulled you down or out, or it was just really heavy surf?
Heavy surf, yeah. And in a place where it wasn't just kind of waves breaking, it was deep water. So it was really just kind of changing the water levels against the cliff so dramatically that it felt like I was in like a white water hydraulic in like a river. Where it was like, the water moving from multiple different directions and you're trying to fight from not being, you know, bashed against lava rock and knocked unconscious.
I mean, you're a SEAL. So, I mean, you actually have very direct experience with stress positions. I mean, don't they in BUDS like tie your hands and feet and put you underwater? You have to hold your breath for X amount of minutes. And sometimes some people have died in this training, right?
Yeah, people, I mean, there have been kind of deaths.
Sadly, I mean, I'm just saying, didn't you actually have direct, unique experience with like how long can you, knowing you can hold your breath, what that feels like, how to deal with extreme stress underwater. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I would imagine some of that went through your head. Or was it just panic?
I fought and, you know, I'm competent and comfortable in the water, but there's a point where, you know, the ocean is more powerful than the strongest swimmer in the world. So I, you know, there was a distinct, it's etched in my memory. There was a distinct kind of evolution of thought as I was in that situation from survival and doing what I need to do to stay afloat and not expend too much energy to, I can't fight forever against something that doesn't have to give up. And I had to kind of reconcile with the fact that I may drown, and that was very likely. And I remember the thoughts entering my mind that I am going to drown. I'm going to feel what this is like. And this is how it's all going to end for me. And that's it's a super heavy situation. I mean, it draws on emotion even now, you know, when I think about it, because it was like, I mean, I faced my mortality in the water that day, and I didn't know at the time, but it gave me one of the greatest gifts that has ever been given to me. And it's, you know, showing me what's really important. And for me in that moment, the only thing that mattered was the loving relationship I had with my children. And, you know, that lesson, that truth for me, which in my mind is love, has now surfaced repeatedly as I have, you know, had the honor of exploring some of these plant medicines that have, in my mind, taken me back to kind of that place of pure consciousness where the only thing that exists and matters is love. And for me, that love manifests, you know, quite often as the love that I have for my kids. That's totally ineffable. You know, I can't describe with 100% accuracy why I feel the way I do about my kids and how powerful that emotion is. But it's, you know, for the first time in my life, it's the only way that I can even comprehend the love that a loving creator has for me and for everybody else.
Mm. Mm. And you said that, like, it wasn't until the plant medicine that you felt like you kind of were able to integrate that feeling or that experience. And how did that come about then? And why was it different with the plant medicine? What was it about that experience that allowed you to make this into something more in your reality as opposed to something that was repressed?
Yeah, I mean, so I'll start by saying I locked it away for probably a year and did not say a thing, didn't want to talk about it. And, you know, in the course of that year, you know, probably like just, you know, probably 8 months afterwards, I started to come across other friends from the SEAL community that had gotten out and had been afforded the opportunity to have a major psychedelic experience outside of the U.S. You know, they had gone down to a retreat in Mexico and had been administered ibogaine and 5-MeO-DMT as part of
That's a big combo.
It's a big combo, yeah.
And I don't mean combo the frog. I mean, were these people dealing with addiction? Or in particular?
So some of them were, and that's traditionally what ibogaine has been seen as a powerful anti-addiction measure.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a lot of them were just dealing with a lot of, I guess, depressive symptoms, depression, anxiety, I guess things that normally are associated with post-traumatic stress disorder as it's framed. But what we are coming to find, I guess, and this isn't definitive, but, you know, the common theme within the special operations community has been exposure to a lot of concussive injury, to blast injury, which...
CTE symptoms?
Yes, CTES. So it's been labeled MTBI, so like mild traumatic brain injury.
Mm.
And the, you know, it's caused... like all of the symptoms that are commonly associated with PTSD. Yet I will tell you that myself and a lot of the guys will tell you that we don't feel like we suffer with PTSD. Like we weren't traumatized by the things that we saw and did and encountered overseas. for all the reasons that, you know, I explained earlier, like we, you know, we didn't compromise our morals or our ethics. We held the high ground. We did what was right. We didn't feel like we were compromising, you know, our humanity overseas, which typically is what leads to, you know, kind of a traumatic reaction. And I think it was really the MTBI that kind of put a lot of the guys into this headspace, you know, of just apathy, depression, inability to feel and connect. And, you know, for some guys, it went as far as suicidal ideation, you know, wanting, I mean, and the veteran suicide epidemic is real. And a lot of guys suffer with mental health issues. And we as a community are identifying a lot of that as being sourced from concussive injury.
But I also heard you say earlier that there was this level of compartmentalization and not grieving that
sure.
is a deep emotional component to yep. the depression you felt.
Yep.
So, I mean, it seems like it could be a both and.
I think it is. I think there's a combo of the concussive injury and then, you
it's
know,
unconscious
what makes...
in a lot of ways, you know, the grief and like just what you're might, maybe you didn't feel you compromised your personal morals, but just witnessing it or just like we said on a larger level being a part of something that in your heart just feels like, is this what I want to do or is this right for me, you know, but it's never accessed or never even questioned on a conscious level.
Yeah
well, when you say mild concussive injury, do you mean like from demolition or from just gunfire or from
all of the above? I mean, people mm-hmm. think that it has to be direct exposure to like an IED blast.
Right.
But it's, you know, we train to be very effective in kind of that small period of time that we're actually in combat. You know, it's no different than the NFL player that spent his entire career in grade school, high school, college, and the pros prepping for that, you know, that Super Bowl game that only lasts for a short period of time. So most of the trauma, most of the concussive injury is in training, you know, exposure
sure.
to blast and demolition, gun, you know, automatic weapons fire, parachuting, chronic stress, you know, disrupted sleep patterns, you know, all these things compound over time. So
all these sort of non-human things that they right. make a human go through. And it's like, it's challenging for the human spacesuit.
Yeah. And you get really good at, you know, dealing with stress. So like we stress inoculate in training, and that's probably where a lot of that compartmentalization comes from, is like you get good at, you know, zoning everything else out and focusing on the mission at hand, the task at hand. And I would agree with you. I think it is a combo of kind of this deep emotional compartmentalization and the exposure to concussive injury, and it kind of creates the perfect storm. And that's what guys were going through every alternative they possibly could to get off antidepressants and opiates and sleep medication to fix themselves. You know, everything from transcranial magnetic stimulation to hyperbaric oxygen therapy and anything else that they could do to kind of better themselves. And, you know, the early guys that went through kind of the initial therapy, the psychedelic therapy, it was kind of like a last ditch effort. It was, hey, I really don't have anything to lose. I'm not getting better. My family's suffering. I'm suffering. I've thought about taking my life. You know, why not? And the initial guys went through it, and it had a miraculous impact on their life. And from those initial experiences, a nonprofit was born that a friend of mine, Marcus Capone, and his wife, Amber Capone, started called VETS, Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions. And that has kind of been the nonprofit that is, you know, focused on, you know, advocacy, research, and ultimately providing grants for, you know, veterans to be able to go and seek these alternative therapies in places where they're legal, to be able to, you know, heal. to deal with with the trauma, both emotionally and physically, that they'd gone through during a career of service in the military.
And hopefully there'll be more access to that in the States. There seems like soon. Did you have any experience with MDMA therapy, or is it because you know that compared to Ibogaine or 5-MeO are very different experiences,
right?
In intensity, on many levels.
Yeah. So I have personally not yet. I mean, I was kind of kind of thrust into the deep end. I mean, I prepped very well before I went into the first experience.
Was yours Ibogaine?
So for me, it was actually kind of backwards. It was supposed to be Ibogaine first, and I had the opportunity to have a 5-MeO experience, and I did that. I committed to it. I prepped, and I always like to emphasize this. Like I'm a planner and a prepper, and I had sought counsel from some very good friends of mine that had a lot of experience in this space. And I started a meditation practice, which has been a gift in and of itself. Like I've been a meditator ever since. And I really got focused on getting ready for what this could be. And that first experience, I didn't know.
I laugh only because I'm like with 5-MeO in particular, which is one experience I haven't had, but I've learned a lot about it from people and a couple of books. And it feels like in the meditation, I totally get it, especially with all psychedelics. It's the number one thing I'd recommend too.
Yeah.
It's sort of with 5-MeO, I'm like, I think it would quickly get to a place where it's like preparation, like a big question mark. And then it just like goes from there. And it's like, way beyond that.
I would agree with you. I mean, I don't think I knew exactly what I was in for.
How can you? Yeah. I mean,
you can't. I mean, it's just like, I didn't know what to expect.
Did you have any psychedelic experience before that?
No, I didn't.
Are you kidding me? That was your first. Wow. So is everything after that just sort of like,
what's funny? It's like, it has opened me up in a way that is, it's forever changed me for the better. I could tell you for certain, I wouldn't be having this conversation today with you and been so inspired by the art that you present to the world through your music if it weren't for that experience. And I say that, and it's not just to kind of pat you on the back. It's something I mean deeply. I mean, I went into that experience not knowing what to expect. It's similar to like not knowing what to expect when I drown. And
I was going to ask you about the parallels between the two experiences.
Yeah, I mean, total. I mean, for me, it was, it took me back to the same place that I went when I had, succumbed to death for a moment in drowning. And for me, it's so simple, and when I talk about it, it almost downplays the significance of the experience. But I was thrust into an interaction with my son when I had taken the 5-MeO. I mean, I was kneeling next to my little boy and just with him, and it was this simple, like timeless interaction of me kneeling next to my son and just looking at him smile and play with his toys, like in our living room, sitting like next to our couch with like sunlight coming through the windows. And there was no voice interaction. It was just, I was just there. And I struggle trying to explain this with accuracy, but it wasn't a memory. It wasn't a vision or something. It was as real as me going home right now and kneeling next to my son and watch him play. So, I say that it's simple, but it was profound because it was showing me the exact same thing that I saw when I had drowned. I mean, I was basically with both my son and my daughter as I was in the water, drowning, basically surrendering to the situation that I was in. And in the water that day, I went from complete redline heart rate and survival mode to complete serenity and peace, where, you know, I had, you know, I hate to say gave up, but I mean, I just kind of surrendered to the reality of the situation. And I saw my son and my daughter, and I, you know, I was with them, and I felt totally at peace and totally comfortable. And you know, it's that scared me. But when I came back to it in that first major psychedelic experience, like, I believe that it showed me that for a reason. Like, it really galvanized my understanding of what love is and how important that love that I have for my kids is in my life. I mean, it's a center point in my life, and it's the only thing that has really helped me understand and feel the love that God has for me. I mean,
and
that's
why why did it stick that time when it happened in the water in Hawaii? Like, what about this experience coming back around made it stick?
I think it
changed your life. You know,
it gave me another opportunity to look at it and understand what was actually happening. I mean, I think I suppressed the first experience because it just scared me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I see.
I felt like I was letting go of life and losing everything that I had.
Does that make sense to you now? Doesn't it feel like you're gaining everything you
have? Yeah, I mean,
that's
the thing, man. It's like I'm gaining everything. I mean, like right now, my eyes are completely open. My heart is open. I put my children at the top of my list of priorities. And I feel like I'm living in heaven, or however you want to frame it, every single day by embracing the present moment with my kids and other people that I love deeply. And I feel like, you know, for me, the afterlife is here now. I mean, my afterlife, and I touched it. I truly believe I touched it for a moment, but it's just, you know, sitting and soaking in the loving relationships that are here for us right now. You don't have to wait for them. It's not like there's some miraculous shift and you go to, you know, some place that's better than what you have now. Like for me, being with my little boy and just watching the joy on his face and the innocence and the reciprocation of love that he has for me is like, you know, it doesn't get more perfect than that.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. I mean, tell me, how has this work and this place that you've started to walk into allowed you to do any of that grief work from the previous parts of your life? How did that come into play as a way of feeling this presence?
Well, in that same experience, there was kind of like this exposure to that pure ethereal love like I have for my son. But at the same time, at the end of the experience, I mean, I shared that I lost a younger brother in an inbounds avalanche. And, you know, I love my brother Chris dearly. I mean, so deeply that when I lost him, you know, it's a pain that I can't do justice explaining. And in that same experience, I grieved openly, in a way that I had not grieved since I had lost my brother Chris. And if you ever heard somebody, you know, wail when they've lost something that, you know, means so much to them, you would, you'd understand, you know, and I felt like I was gifted that release of emotion and kind of, that reconnection to that deep grief. And it showed me that it was just another manifestation of the same love that I had for my little boy, or I have for my little boy. And it just surfaces in a different way. And that it's, I mean, that's why I keep going back to love as being kind of the core truth, is because, you know, as deep and painful as that loss was, it showed me that it is still all love. You know, I felt such deep love for him, and it kind of emanated from me in kind of that expression of grief. And so I got kind of like the 1-2 combo you know, in like this beautiful like embrace of love for my child, and then this gut-wrenching expression of love for my brother in losing him.
A kind of cycle of life there.
Oh, dude. Right. I mean, it was like, it was the most mind-blowing experience of my entire life. And it kind of brought it, the near-death experience, back front and center. And it's like, I think I was supposed to get that out of the near-death experience. And I don't think I was ready to comprehend it and integrate it. And, you know, I needed to go back and touch that again to truly integrate this change in my life. And it's changed me forever. I mean, my wife will tell you I'm a totally different person. I guess I'm the person that she knew when we started dating senior year in high school. You know, I'm the lighthearted, loving, you know, bright-eyed person that I was, not the flat, you know, stoic person that I became.
Well, I've heard that a lot of SEALs marriages don't last. And
we struggle. I mean, a lot of our marriages
very
struggle.
Low percentage or something. So it's nice to hear yours is still around.
Yeah. No, it's flourishing too. You know, I love my wife deeply. And
yeah, that's great. I mean, and you found that with other vets, are they having similar experiences of being able to grieve? And does some of that have to do with, like you said, what they witnessed, and maybe even dealing with like their role in it? You know, like you can be in part of this machine. You're like, well, I'm part of the military and I take orders and I do what needs to be done and I have my morals and my values. But then it's like you get into those states of the soul and it's like, maybe you need to grieve the life you have taken or the actions you have taken that, if you're really honest with yourself, you would have chosen, you wish you didn't, if you weren't part. I mean, if it was simple and it's just like, I just can do whatever I want. Do I want to be part of such and such? And they have to be honest with themselves about their participation without my judgment or anyone's judgment. It's just their judgment that's been there, perhaps, that they've never accessed. Have you been finding that and finding that this kind of work is more effective for them than other treatments?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that release of grief has definitely been a big part of it. I mean, I've been able to witness that in friends of mine that were very callous and very shut off from emotional connection. And, right. You know, some of those relationships are just completely 180 out from what they were, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. You know, deep connection to each other, you know, guys. Well, and I'll say this too. It's like, you know, guys aren't, they loved being part of the SEAL teams and they loved doing what we did because I can tell you for certain, you know, the guys feel like they were an instrument of justice and good. You know, guys truly, truly believe that. And I believe it as well, you know, going over, I mean, like, most guys will frame themselves as the guy that wants to go out or wanted to go out on the playground as a kid and punch the bully in the face that was pushing the little girl down, or somebody that was too weak to protect themselves. So that's the mindset of the guys that are, you know, that I served with in the community, is like they're kind of the sheepdogs protecting the sheep from the wolves. And, you know, I know that that's truly at their core, that's how guys believe. That's what guys believe. I can tell you that the release of grief and the change in kind of emotional connection and vulnerability and their ability to open up and you know, and deal and cope with just kind of the emotional overload of being in combat, absolutely. You know, regardless of whether you felt like you were on the right side of good, there's still, to your point, there's an emotional toll that's at stake there. I mean, no one wants to just kill, no one wants to inflict harm on another person. I mean, and we're getting to a point now, like having, you know, got on this healing path where, yeah, like the guys that I know, like they want to live a loving life.
They're vegans and they're like, I want to be a humanitarian instead of a warrior of force.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. It's like guys are kind of, you know, they haven't lost the edge, but they don't necessarily identify with kind of who they were before. And I'd say who they were before in that, it's like a, you know, embodiment of anger, you know, and
right.
and aggression.
Force as opposed to, you know, it's very kung fu. It's like,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah.
So trying to be at peace with that, I think guys are really finding peace and, you know, forgiveness too. I mean, and not just for stuff that happened overseas, it's, you know, for all the trauma that, you know, may have been inflicted, like just within their families and the loving relationships that are all around them, you know, isolating themselves, not being there for spouses, for kids, because they're so fixated on the job, you know, all that time away, you know, deployed and, you know, connection with their, you know, their parents and their siblings. I think a lot of guys are just, you know, coming to terms with the fact that it's, you know, life's about surrounding yourself with people that you love and, you know, you can share loving relationships with, you know, and there's so much noise out there that wants to distract us from that simplicity. And I think what these experiences have gifted to guys is just a renewed perspective to be able to see the beautiful simplicity that's right in front of them. And it's all that they need. And they don't need to be part of the, you know, the SEAL teams deploying repeatedly to feel that purpose. Like there's purpose right in front of them in their families and their friends. And it's really become kind of a resurgence in community for a lot of us, you know, be able to kind of heal together, come together and support each other. So
isn't that amazing?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's it. It's all about community, man. I mean, that's been...
The first, like, venture into finding yourself through essentially community and purpose is through this, like, Herculean task of becoming a SEAL through basically deep compartmentalization, as you said, and stress, and how do you deal with stress, and how do you, like, become this laser-focused weapon. And then through that, you kind of lose a sense of yourself, self and the soul. And the way you find that same kind of centeredness then becomes through an open heart and a flow of energy and finding the same food in the things that were always in front of you. It has nothing to do with these vast organizations or levels of accomplishment.
Yeah.
It's just right there. It's receiving what is.
It's right there. You know, we're blind to it for
what
most of our lives.
Yeah.
I mean, and it didn't stop there for me. You know, I mean, I kind of told you I did it backwards. You know, the opportunity to have the 5-MEO experience presented itself, and I jumped at it because I needed it. I needed something. I got what I came for, and I actually was a little bit trepidatious as it was related to Ibogaine and the experience. I had just heard.
Sure. Yeah. That's heavy duty. Yeah.
It's heavy duty. You know, I've heard, you know, I mean, I always frame it as like, there's risk involved with Ibogaine and Iboga,
yes.
You know, cardiac risk. And, you know, the guys were all going to kind of a, providers that were taking the necessary precautions, you know, doing all the blood work, all the EKG, all the medical oversight and supervision during the experience. But I still was scared. I mean, let's be honest.
Beyond that, I mean, that's all true. Plus, it's a very long experience, and it can be rather intense, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's one that, like, you could look at mushrooms, psilocybin, or LSD, you know, things that had a recreational component. I don't know of anyone who was probably doing Ibogaine recreationally. And it was probably done, from what I understand, inside the traditions previously for some pretty intense, like, ancestral work or, like, healing work. It was, like, probably rarely done for individuals. You know, it's like, that's a big deal, you know, for diving into this.
It was like a rite of passage, you know, for the
exactly. Belief, that's right? The right word. Yeah.
And I mean, in a way, you know, it's the Bwiti are using it and still use it as a way to connect with, you know, ancestors and God, and as a rite of passage, you know, into like a second chapter in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think there's a really interesting parallel in that, you know, you have a bunch of guys, warriors that are, you know, kind of closing one chapter and trying to open a new chapter in life. And it's a rite of passage for our guys. I mean, it's been, I mean, I can speak to my personal experience. You know, I'm thankful that I did move forward and go through with it. I had a very beautiful experience. It's not always that way. I mean, you face, you know, the hard truths of what you have done and what you have experienced, and there's no sugarcoating it. And, you know, for me, I, you know, it got to show me a lot of things that, you know, maybe have atrophied in my life, you know, relationships with, you know, relationship with my mom, you know, with another sibling, I got to kind of address kind of, you know, those compartmentalized feelings of loss for my brother and for my father, and really kind of see the beauty in, you know, the relationship that has always been there with my wife and my kids, but just how beautiful and how important it is to me. I mean, it was just like this beautiful, you know, 8-12 hour, you know, kind of masterclass on, you know, what matters in my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I came out of it changed for sure. You know, it was just further galvanization of the things that I took out of the 5MEO experience. And yeah, just very, very, very beautiful. Now, not everybody's experience has been like that. You know, it can be very tough. You know, the truth is hard sometimes. You know, facing the truth is something that people fear. You know, there's a lot of things that you don't want to, you know, admit yeah. that you had kind of taken the wrong path or misstepped or were, you know, not the best person to other people in your life. And you know, you kind of, it's like a day of reckoning to be able to, you know, come to grips with choices that you've made that may have been harmful, not only to you, but to other people. And
sure.
You know, it's like pure accountability. And, you know, I come from a community where accountability is key. You know, we hold ourselves accountable for the things that we do, especially in the environment that we're going into as SEALs. And this is like ultimate personal accountability, you know, for your life. And sure. Yeah, I mean, absolute blessing. I mean, and there's other, you know, beyond the psycho-spiritual, you know, effects of the Ibogaine experience, you know, there's a lot of research pointing to kind of anti-inflammatory benefits, you know, for the brain, you know, as it relates to kind of the MTBI portion. So there's, you know, a lot of people are pointing to like that having, you know, a major impact on inflammation that may have been caused by kind of chronic concussive injury over time.
Yeah. That being, you know, that's incredible if we find more information about that, because we can see sort of these chemical and emotional benefits, and to think that there's sort of this actually physical brain-based benefit as well could be quite profound in working with vets in particular, but maybe even certain degenerative brain diseases. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, with Alzheimer's, dementia. You know, and a lot of people grow up as athletes, you know, the concussive injury.
Right.
I mean, little people know, like, soccer is like a major source of concussive injury, you know, especially for females. Yeah. I had no idea, like, you know, like heading the soccer ball, like as a, you know, as like a female soccer player, like people were telling me like, yeah, like there's a lot of, you know, and I say female because like, you know, a female has, you know, doesn't have the same type of support at a young age, like in their neck to kind of support, you know, kind of concussive injury. And, you know, young girls that are like heading soccer balls and that, I mean, I guess produces like a pretty high level of concussion that they have to deal with. So it's like, it was this thing that like, I thought it was just all like, you know, young men that are playing football that are, you know, at risk for concussions and potentially, you know, early onset Alzheimer's, dementia, CTE, and all these things. But, you know, I think it impacts society as a whole. You know, most of our society is exposed to these things. And, you know, maybe it does serve a purpose for, you know, more than just the, you know, the guys that are playing professional football and, you know, in concussive, you know, blast events.
Sure. Sure. Navy SEALs. I mean,
right.
Yeah. There could be broad applications, which is interesting. And interesting to hear your experience, man. I mean, I appreciate you sharing all that, and you're tracking your timeline with it. And it's exciting to think how this is starting to make its way into these circles and becoming more accepted. It takes a lot of vulnerability to step into these spaces. You know, in a lot of ways, the pain you might feel is not allowing that vulnerability to emerge, but that seems to be the doorway to the healing through the grief, through the acceptance, through the forgiveness, and so forth. So hearing that is inspiring.
Well, and it's opened me up. I mean, I'll talk about like the focus on integration, you know, and that's a big focus for the nonprofit is, you know, these experiences are wonderful, but they're just short catalysts that open you up to this vulnerability that, you know, allows you to kind of grow as a human being. I mean, I've opened myself up to therapy. You know, I it's actually been something that I've grown through. I've found meditation as a lifelong practice. You know, I have a new love for music. I mean, that was the initial connection to you. I mean, I literally like the thing that I enjoy more than anything else in the world is like sitting in my little ice bath at home, listening.
Ice bath,
dude. Every morning I sit
chilling in the ice bath.
I chill in the ice bath and
crazy man.
I turn on some of your music and then, you know, go out in the backyard, which I never did this before. And it's only, it hasn't been until recently where I go in the backyard and realize that I have like this wonderful morning sunlight and I rewarm naturally in the backyard, listening to some East Forest, and my neighbors probably think I'm crazy, but, it's like the most simple, beautiful experience that I can go back to every single day. And I'm thankful for it, but it's all part of like my integration and my growth. And I just can't emphasize the importance of kind of that lifelong commitment to integrate after a profound experience with psychedelic medicine, because that's where the magic is. You know, you have to instill that change permanently.
So for you, that integration is a kind of giving space and time for it. Is that what you feel like allowed? Like it's sort of an opportunity for reflection/meditation, witnessing or stopping in a way? Is that what it feels like to you?
I mean, because these experiences, regardless of whether it's through ibogaine or psilocybin or MDMA, you know, you're given an opportunity to experience, you know, kind of consciousness that's very unique. And sometimes it's overwhelming and confusing, but you know, it takes time to really pull everything out of it. And you shouldn't look at these experiences as kind of the magic pill that's just going to make you better immediately. I mean, all it does is open the opportunity up for you to really juice everything you can out of that experience and, you know, galvanize it permanently into your life.
Yeah, it takes a form of practice. You know, yep. It's sort of recognizing that each day we chop the wood, carry the water, and you figure out the way that helps you become a kind of exercise, because it's not just like an idea. You know, learning an idea and bringing that into your life is certainly one thing. And those felt experiences are very powerful, as you're saying. Everything we bring into our life becomes into that, you know, these choice bricks, these forms of small action and big action that makes it become part of the walk, as opposed to just a memory.
Yeah.
I can't agree more. And that's wonderful. So is there anything that you're doing now that you wanted to mention or that you feel like is important that people should know about that relates to this?
I mean, my message out there for everybody, it's like, you know, we all experience trauma. We all have things that we can address. You know, there's an opportunity for people just to open themselves up, whether it's open themselves up to vulnerability, whether it's via an experience with psychedelic medicine or just embracing, you know, the present in, you know, meditation or just time with friends and family. I mean, I think everybody can benefit from that. I encourage people to be more vulnerable, you know, put yourself out there. Don't fear judgment. And, you know, a lot of good comes from that. And it's you know, if I couldn't share anything else, that would be it. It's like I've pulled so much from kind of relinquishing my fear of judgment and being more vulnerable, because I don't think I was for most of my life. I think I stayed guarded and I suffered because of it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful message. Well, thank you for sharing. I really appreciated hearing about it. And what would you like us to, what can I link to like at the, in the show notes of this?
I mean, you know, I'm on Instagram, which I guess everybody is nowadays. So I'm like Nick underscore Norris, I think 1981, if I'm correct. And then, you know, Vets, vetsolutions.org is the nonprofit that is really kind of like paving the way for advocacy and research. So if people want to check out Vets, I think it's great. And then, you know, you can also find me. I have a company that I started that's, you know, kind of built around the concept of like simple routines to promote, you know, elevated wellness. So at Protect Life is the handle for our little company. And, you know, we're focused on just hydration and better sleep. You know, two things that I think have been critical for
huge first step there. Yeah.
Yeah. Drink more water and sleep better. You know, those two things, if I couldn't do anything else, I would stay better hydrated and try to get better sleep.
Dig it. Cool. Nick Norris, thank you very much.
No, my pleasure.
Thank you, Nick, for coming on the show. You can check out what he's up to. And his conversation over with Tim Ferriss was a great one if you want to hear more from Nick. And I'm sure we'll touch base again. This song that you're hearing in the background is called All We Have, and it's the East Forest remix. It's Evelyn and Sweater Beats put this song together, and I did the remix, and it is now out wherever you listen to music. I did this remix actually quite a while ago, so it's fun to finally hear it get out there, but I was kind of vibing on like a Bruce Hornsby piano thing, if I could ever be like Bruce Hornsby. And something, of course, emotional and swelling is just where it wanted to go. So check out the song. You can just go to wherever you listen to music. If you look at my own catalog, it is the latest single. And then this Friday on June 11th, 2021, we're going to be releasing the next song from Possible. This one's called Bones, featuring Bio Akamolafe. And Bio, that name might sound familiar because he was on the podcast here, the 10 Laws podcast, one of my favorite episodes. And I actually sampled bits from that podcast and used it because his spoken word is featured in the song. I had never done that before, and I think it's super cool. He was all the way over in India when we did the podcast. It's just amazing, like, that's even possible. You know, I know we take that sort of stuff for granted, but I'm sorry. That's amazing. Like, someone's in India, and I'm in Idaho, and I'm recording him in real time, and then that becomes a song, and then he's gracious enough to say, yeah, go for it. Put it out there. So the song Bones comes out on Friday, and I think you're going to dig it. It's really beautiful. And we can dive into that more in a future episode. But thank you guys for the support. Thanks to everyone on the East Forest Council on Patreon, patreon.com/eastforest, and for leaving reviews on Apple Podcasts. It makes a big difference. Thank you so much. Always a 5-star review makes a big difference. Okay, keep walking your walk, my friends. I'll catch you next week. Don't take any shit, but if you do, do it with grace.